This episode of Yes But Why podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah.
The industry just keeps changing. Like every 5 years it changes. And so there's no clear path in terms of how and where to do things. You just have to have that personality that's just say, well, screw it, I'm just gonna do it anyway.
So a second ago you had said we now call it scripted versus unscripted. Does that mean, because you're talking about right now, like that it's changed over time? Are the like monikers referring to styles different than they were like 5-10 years ago or when you started? Because that when you mentioned it kind of was like, I wonder if it's just like the word for it or whatever. Like
it could be. I mean, I think it's probably a better question for an academic, but I would say that.
But I just mean like in your experience, in my, like you have to do it. So like if you walk into a room at a meeting and they say like, by the way, you should say this instead of that, you know, I wondered. I think, maybe they didn't and I'm putting
history
in the
room. I think in a sense we have to be just more careful with our wording in general. And one of the things is that documentaries are narratives and we can't say that they're, you know, that they're not. They're constructed as narratives.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to say that they're unscripted narratives versus, you know, because there's so many forms of documentary filmmaking. Then some of them are, you know, do resemble something similar to the news, but others are really constructive stories. And we can't really say they're not documentaries because of that. So it's just such a broad category. And then with scripted films, it's the same because now scripted films take in portions, even my film that I just shot, they take in portions that are shot almost like a documentary where you go into authentic locations and your B-roll that you're shooting is going to mix in with your scripted forms. And so they're, you know, they're constantly using both categories. So I think it's just easier to say scripted versus non-scripted.
But it's not like you're, you know, in different camps. Like when you're meeting people, when you're presenting your films, it wasn't because you had done some documentaries earlier in 2012 and thereabouts, and now this one is, you know, a scripted piece.
Right.
Do you feel like the experience of like talking about it and presenting it at festivals and stuff is different? Do people take you differently?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, well, it's different because I guess it depends on your purpose of why you made the film.
Sure.
Because so my previous one was called The Children's War. It was a feature-length documentary about children abducted in war in northern Uganda. So in a sense, I'm trying to educate people on what's happening in the world and get, you know, it's slightly like almost like an activist approach. Whereas with the current film, you know, I guess we're more, I'm also always, I guess in a sense, I'm always trying to introduce something people might not have seen before.
Right.
So there is always a sense of education to it. But with this one, it's not so much activism as it is, you know, trying to attempt something related to art. So I think it just comes down to the intention of why you made it in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, I guess to a certain extent, we're all sort of like taken as we present ourselves. You know, if you're like, I'm steady and I'm a solid person, they're gonna be like, oh, he's a highfalutin filmmaker, as opposed to like, this kid just made a movie. Look at him.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
wearing the hat to the side, chewing gum or whatever, like not dressed up. And you're like, what's happening?
Yeah.
You at your premiere? How's that going?
Yeah. I don't know. And something also changes with age, too, as you get older.
You're right. Yeah. I always forget that. As I'm getting older, it's so funny. Like, I was just talking yesterday about how, like, as I get older, my, like, ideas, I'm getting sort of more puritanical, and I'll like look back at my old self like, oh, I can't believe I did that. And then it's like, don't judge yourself. At the time, it was fine.
Right.
Like, yeah, sure, when you're 40, you're not going to do that. But like when you're 20, you're fine.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, to judge myself in the past is like, oh, whatever. It's okay. Clearly, I grew up into an all right adult.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's something you said for getting older and you think of yourself as being more mature, but at the same time, maybe you're just becoming cynical. Like, it's, you know.
I feel like whenever I feel like I'm more mature, it's actually just an indication of my own confidence. I'm like, oh, that's nice. I'm confident. That's good. Because I'm like, yeah, I'm good. Look at me. I'm so mature. And then I was like, oh, maybe I'm wrong, but at least I have confidence, I guess.
Yeah, and exactly. And like the kind word for maturity is experience, or let's say cynicism is experience.
Yeah, totally.
So, and then I guess the same for naivety. We can, you know, so yeah. I don't know.
I suppose so. So you've been doing this for a while. How did you, mentioned that your journey has been unusual or unlike what you expected it would be. What does that mean?
Well,
I mean, you went to UT, right? That's a pretty solid start.
Yeah, I went to UT. While I was at UT, I was one of the young, so I produced a feature film when I was like 22.
Right.
So that's a great start.
Yeah.
Got distribution for it. I mean, it took a long time. Documentaries take forever. But, anyway, it was distributed. Things were going great. But my background is all in narrative filmmaking and scripted filmmaking, as we're going back to.
Yeah.
So, and my passion for filmmaking and storytelling was always in scripted and fiction. And so after the documentary released, I really wanted to go back to my roots. My fiance was, at the time, my girlfriend. She moved to Nepal, or she was planning to go to Nepal to study, and I had always wanted to live in the Himalayas. So it was like the perfect little, you know, sojourn to take care of, that I could go back to my roots of writing and go into the Himalayas. And time passed. I ended up teaching there. I ended up doing a lot of things. I have a lot of hobbies and get into things. And I stayed for 8 years. So on my last, at the very end, I wrote and directed this film that is, you know, and while I was there, I wrote tons of stuff. Like, I spent so much of my time writing and had a wonderful time, but I've spent most of my adult life abroad, or, you know, and not just abroad, but living in developing countries and gaining a great deal, learning different languages and cultures, religions, all sorts of things that have inspired my writing in a million ways. But it's definitely been a course that is not similar to most of my filmmaker friends, you know. So, you know, and I had always, I don't know, romanticized the life of people like, I don't know, Jack London or Hemingway, or people who'd really gone, writers who had gone, explored, had life experience and adventures, and then really tried to write from a place of their own experience and authenticity, although their form was still fiction. I had always looked up to that and thought that was, you know, I guess in a sense what I was trying to do. And so now
yeah,
I think
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's a huge risk as a filmmaker, because you're kind of leaving during these prime years. So like, I distributed a film, I had a lot of opportunities right after that to jump right in, and instead of doing that, I left, which is a huge risk.
Mm.
So there's the downside, but the other side is that if you really do go out, adventure, and gain something from it, then I have no shortage of ideas of things I want to make.
Yeah, plus there's something to be said for different ways in which to get in the game, meaning like, yeah, I've definitely, and I appreciate the moving up the rungs in the basic way, PAing, then moving up to whatever next rung you're looking for. You want to be a director, you want to be an actor, like how you get in, you know, working your way in certain offices to get people to know you. Sure, there's that as a path, but it would seem to me that would be more of a like business minded path, like get a business degree and then go do that if you'd like, because that's pretty much the effort you're putting in. Whereas it would seem to me that you are doing the sort of artist's way, a la, you know, Hemingway and all that. You wanted to experience life. I mean, and even the talk we had 3 seconds ago about like maturity and experience, like you had to experience the world to even put through. I mean, you're from Texas, right?
Right.
So you're from Texas, and then you're like, cool, after college, I'm going to go to Nepal. Like, I bet your parents were like, what is happening? But it's an amazing adventure. And the fact that you stayed there for 8 years means that you didn't just, like, have a vacation. You had a life.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I didn't fully understand that when you live abroad, learning the language is essential. You can't ever say you truly lived in a place if you can't speak the language fluently, because you'll never really know the people or the culture that's there. And so I was really fortunate that I was able to meet my Nepali sister now. There's a tradition in Nepali culture where a woman can make a man her brother. And so I became part of her family, and she was my main Nepali teacher. And we ended up co-teaching at the university, and we wrote the book that they now use to teach Nepali language. So
awesome.
Yeah. So I had an amazing experience there. I certainly couldn't have had this full immersive experience without that, without the language, without my sister, without, you know, being part of that. And absolutely, I think I had this beautiful gift that I've had crazy adventures throughout the Himalayas. I've stayed in the most remote villages, escaped avalanches, same in Uganda. So I've had this amazing life. I wouldn't take back a second of it. But
and you seem to be sharing it with your partner as well. Like, that's so wonderful.
Yeah.
How many, even artists, how many of us, like, separate from our partners just to go do the art? And then we're like, listen, I'll be back. I got to go to wherever for 6 months. Like, see ya. And then you come back. There's a lot of that. But the fact that you guys got to go together.
Yeah. Yeah,
and have this
true.
Adventure together, like, that's both, like, having your artistic thing, and also you get this, like, love romance adventure. Like,
yeah, totally.
Guys, these are two separate movies happening at once, and one of them's very educational, and one of them is a rom-com that I'm loving. Like, that's so awesome.
Yeah.
Is she also involved in the arts and, like, helps you with the movies and writing, or is she doing a totally separate thing?
No, she's a translator. She speaks seven languages, so
awesome.
Yeah. So her focus is basically to translate for Buddhist texts and Buddhist teachers, and so...
So cool.
Yeah. And so in a sense, I mean, well, she did just translate this short film into French, the subtitles into French and Spanish for me. So I guess in a sense,
yeah,
she
perfect.
Does. Think, but otherwise,
so much better to get someone who knows you to do the translation.
Yeah, absolutely.
I watched a couple at the festival that I was like, this is a terrible like translation that I'm reading right now. Like, and I feel bad for the person.
No, I saw a couple as well. And it's always a sticking point because I know how hard it is. I've subtitled several films of my films, and I know how hard it is to translate when you're relying on someone else to translate humor, to translate everything, and to do it in just like 32 characters or whatever, you know, as much as you can read as while that text is on screen. And it's just it's a very hard thing to do. I remember, like, even shooting a documentary when I was interviewing people in Uganda, and I was relying on translation, and also had an interviewer. We're both relying on a translator, an interpreter, actually. So when I got back with the footage, I had it all translated because half the footage, I didn't even know what it meant while I was shooting. And then, so when I finally gave it to another friend, they're like, no, all your interpretation was wrong while you're there. And they started translating it separately. I was like, oh my God, these kids, they're funny and they're making jokes. And I had no idea in the process. And you just think, wow, like, what I would have asked if I had known they had said that. And so that's what made this experience in Nepal so different, because it was different because it's scripted, so it's a fiction. But I was also speaking with directing them in Nepali. They don't speak a word of English.
Right.
So I was able to really talk through it. And then, of course, I wrote something in script. But, you know, these are kids. Mine is about child monks. And so, you know, I would talk to them throughout. Like, well, what would you say to your friend in this situation? And they would say, and they have their own kind of language. And although no one who watches the film would understand it, for me, it's another level of authenticity because it's really the way they speak, not the way, you know, this traditional grammatically correct form of Nepali. So anyway, it just makes a huge difference to have that.
Yeah, to be so deep in that culture and to be able to experience it and, like, have it all around you. And now, did you sort of wait to make a movie until towards the end of your journey because you were trying to find the best idea, or you were trying to become the most ready to do, like, what you're talking about? Because you're right, like, I can see how it would be much better to be the director and actually speak the language of the actors. Like, that seems like a given you should have, and it's awesome that you did.
I'll give you a very honest answer.
I don't know if I should say uh-oh or what.
So when I went to Nepal originally, I was so fed up with, because as a filmmaker, particularly as a low budget filmmaker, you spend so much of your time raising money. And when I went to Nepal, I decided to just leave directing behind and just focus on writing, which is my just as much of a passion of mine as directing. And so I ended up doing a lot of writing, but I decided my life would be so much better and so much easier if I didn't have to find funding for these films, and I'm just not going to direct anymore. And so that went on, and then towards the end, one of my very close friends, who is the director of photography, Michael Eisenbeck, he's an Austrian cinematographer, and he had just come into some equipment. And anyway, it was right as I was moving and leaving Nepal, and he got the equipment. And he had always wanted to shoot a film together, and I said, "Well, now I'm moving, and now you got the equipment." And I said, "Okay, well, let's go talk to the abbot of the monastery. Let's figure out if we can get permission, because he's very close with the abbot as well, and I also worked in this monastery, and this to get access with the child monks is a very rare thing." And so I ended up, we had a very limited amount of time. I wrote the script in like 24 hours. I ended up pre-production was 2 weeks. It was crazy, and especially if you see the film, you'll see like how many extras, how many, you know, there in any given shot there are 20 kids or 40 monks, so it's a massive production to just do with a tiny crew and almost no planning or pre-production. So it was tough. But anyway, my point is just that I started out trying to write, just to write, and then this opportunity came, and I said, "Okay, like it's like a part of me had been asleep." And then so finally I got to direct, and it was just getting into pre-production. It was like a part of me just came alive that I had been pushing away for so long, and suddenly I realized, yeah, this is a part of me. I can't just do writing. It's like choosing between two children, and you know, I couldn't do it. So then as soon as I started directing, I was just so happy again. And then I realized, I was like, yeah, I have to do both, unfortunately.
It's so interesting how, you know, that kind of stuff, we try to control our own destiny and like, oh no, this is what I really want. It's like, no, hold on. You'll tell yourself
Well, I
in
mean,
whatever way.
it happened in the beginning. I went to Nepal, actually, so I tell you, I was going the sort of route of these novelists who I love, but I actually decided to go the way of writing novels. I was fed up with funding. You know, you don't have to raise money to write a book. And so I started doing that, and I wrote, and I had these crazy adventures, and I was writing, but it always, everything was too cinematic. Everything I was writing, I kept getting worried because no one would see the lighting, no one would hear the music, no one, I couldn't do any sound design for a book. And so then my sister came to visit. It was about 3 years in that I was in Nepal, and we were, you know, I was telling her this problem, and she said, "Why don't you just try screenwriting?" I was like, "You don't understand. I put it aside." She said, "Just do it for 3 weeks. If you don't like it, then fine." And so I went back to screenwriting, and it was like within an hour, I was like finally putting on, you know, it's like you finally get the tool in your hand that's really the tools that fit, and you've been using someone else's tools. So yeah, as soon as I put all it on and started writing again, screenwriting for me, I was like, oh my God, I can breathe again. And I'm not trying to do something that's not me.
Oh my God, that's such a wonderful feeling. Oh man, when you can finally like connect with what you really need to do. And it can be hard, like the uphill battle of it with the funding and all the business stuff. But I feel like, you know, maybe you found, and hopefully you can find your own way to accomplish it without having to like, you know, take the uphill battle. Or you know, maybe like your Austrian friend who showed up and was like, "By the way, I have all the equipment. You don't have to worry about it." Maybe you'll all of a sudden make friends with a guy who's like, "Money, I got money." And you're like, "Great."
I hope so. I definitely have friends where things have worked out the way they do for that. I'm a very stubborn person, so the minute that I say I'm going to do something, you know, I'll put my head through a wall before I give up on it. So that's just, it's the same way you know, it's like I decided to learn a little Nepali. Well, no, I had to write the book on how to learn Nepali, and then I had to become the first Western teacher at the university. You know, it's just like my wife always says, just like, if there's a way to do something, you're going to find the hardest possible way and still do it. So, I, you know, I couldn't just make a short film. I had to go live in a place and work with them and speak the language in order, you know what I mean? So I hope.
I don't know. Part of me feels like you should just keep making movies, but then also hire a documentarian, just be with you, doing you watching you, so that you get both parts and you make two movies at once.
Oh my God.
Because it's like, you're so interesting in the way that you create your journey. Like, I would love to watch the movie of you angrily writing novels and Nepal for 3 years before some, you know, blonde girl shows up and goes like, just write a screenplay. And you know, it's like, ding, like, oh my God. Like, I just love even just the story that you're telling me is cinematic. I'm like, yes. And then it'll be, you know, then all of a sudden your wife shows up and she says, but your dream really is. I get a little intense about it, but you know what I mean? Like, you have such a fun journey. I feel like that in and of itself will buoy you in the tougher times.
And I found that for me, you know, particularly with writing and directing with film, it's just, there's really nothing, there are a million things I've done that I enjoy doing and that they're a challenge and I love challenges, but these are different in the sense that I can't sleep at night because I can't wait to wake up and write and I can't wait to wake up and work. And when you do that, you kind of forget it. You kind of just don't care about making money at that point. You just, it's like, actually at the conference, it was nice because there's so many people, there's so many of these people on the panels who, and they say the same thing. They say, if you can do anything else and be happy, just do it because you're going to have a much easier life. But if you simply can't, if this is you, this is something you have to do, then, you know, there is a route for you. And I think that that's what, you know, that's what I've experienced as well.
Yeah.
Where it gives you so much fulfillment in your life, but you have to be willing to deal with the heartache.
Not to mention the fact that, like, you kind of have to be appreciative of every part of it, even if at the end of the day you're not Brad Pitt or, like, you know, you're not whoever famous person.
Absolutely.
Like, you had this journey. No one else had that journey. You got to do this. Even the book where you're, like, teaching and, like, this language, like, that is so sort of side of your, like, artistic career, but it's so part of the full journey.
Totally.
But it's yours. And it's like, no one else gets to have that. That's your adventure forever.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's something about that like makes that in and of itself fulfilling, as well as now after, there's a whole secondary journey of what it's like for you to present to other people this movie and what that means to them and how it affects this, like, Western audience and everything. Like, also, your perspective must be wild. I mean, how long have you been back from Nepal?
God, I don't even know. But I think, like, less than a year, but it was the hardest because I basically flew in from Kathmandu. I really didn't come home that much, maybe every 3 years for a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So I came in from Kathmandu to Austin to do post-production, and only for a short amount of time. And then I was straight in. I was in the heart of Hollywood for 5-6 months. So just the culture shock of going from basically Kathmandu to Hollywood was really intense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was tough.
Wow.
I feel like I'm still adjusting in a lot of ways, but definitely those first months were harder than I expected them to be.
I wonder, at the very beginning, we were talking about, like, you're trying to decide where to settle. I wonder if that's part of the lesson, like, between the lifestyle you're used to in Nepal and the lifestyle that you had when you were in Hollywood trying to develop that, like, maybe you need to find the middle ground.
Yeah.
Like, wherever that might be. And maybe it's Austin, maybe it's Denver, who knows? Maybe it's Atlanta. Who knows where you can find the sort of peace and calm and distance and maybe artistic freedom, but also be able to, also an international airport's going to be helpful for you.
Yeah, no, I think you're totally right. I think it just comes down to being in an environment that's inspirational.
Yeah.
You know? And if you have, there are just, some people have that spark that they just want to storytell or whatever it is, whatever art form. And you have to protect that. Like, that's a very rare thing. And so if it takes living in a certain place in order to protect that, you've got to do it. So I'm still figuring out if that's something that I have to be, that I can, you know, continue to do in LA. I think I'm one of the few people who really like LA.
Honestly, most of the people I know that live there enjoy it quite
really?
A bit.
Yeah.
Actually, it gets a bad rap from people who don't live there.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what it is.
Yeah. I mean, visiting, if you don't know the place and you don't know
sure.
where to go, it's a little tough. But, you know, I do love Austin. My heart's always kind of been in Austin. Austin. So if there's a way for me to continue making films and living in Austin, or at least, you know, being some of the, a lot of part-timers who go between Austin and LA, that would be fantastic. Like, I would love to do that.
Interesting. So are you right now focused solely on the promotion of Yarn, or are you working on another project?
Yeah, I'm actually working on several projects.
Yeah, so. You are.
Yeah, so I have a...
you don't have to tell me about everything, but no secrets, but please tell me anything you'd like to share.
Well, I have a, you know, I have... basically a nearly finished feature. I just need to do a rewrite, but I'm going to try and get that off the ground really soon. And then I've got an episodic, like a series that I think is really funny. And that's one that I'm also trying to get off the ground there. Those are the two polished, ready to go projects. And then I have about three or four projects that are, you know, rounded off enough to get started. And and so I was actually just had a meeting yesterday about one of them. So anyway, well, yeah. So, I mean, it looks like there's a lot of potential to get some of these projects off the ground. It's a difficult time because there's not a lot of money in features right now. But at the same time, a lot of people I'm talking to are saying, well, there's not a lot of money and features in LA, but in Austin, it's still a lot easier to get stuff off the ground, at least if it's low budget stuff.
Sure.
Yeah. So,
so you're looking to make these all on your own, not like sell the scripts?
Well, the series I definitely want to sell, and, you know, because it's a larger budget thing. There are about two or three projects I have that are larger budget. The small budget ones I'd like to do with, you know, a smaller production company so that we can have just a little more freedom, particularly. Because two of them will be shot internationally. So I think it'll just be easier to move in and out with a small crew and a small, you know, smaller production. At least, you know, I've shot several things now in countries like Nepal. And, you know, when you come in with a big crew and a big budget, it's just a lot harder to get stuff done in a place like that. So, so we'll see. But yeah, one of them's a big passion project, so I'm really excited about that. That's one I think we're going to be moving into really soon.
How did you get to have, I mean, like, I know this is a weird question, but like, how did you get to have the knowledge you have now? Like, you understand sort of like, this thing is going to, like, when you write something, you can look at it and say, like, this will require a bigger budget or a smaller budget, this kind of thing I'm going to sell, this kind I want to do on my own. Like, how do you, where did you learn how to differentiate? And like, how do you have advisors that are like suggesting, hey, this is better for that? Or
no, I mean, well, that would be nice.
But well, no, you're so smart. How do you know?
I mean, I've been making films since I was 18. So,
sure.
That alone, not only have I been making, but I've also taken on many roles on each crew. So I've been an editor, I've been a producer, I've been a, you know, director and writer and cinematographer. So it doesn't mean that I'm, you know, I don't think I'm professional caliber at all those roles, but I have a general working knowledge of those, of what it takes for those things.
Yeah, you learned by experience versus went to school for X degree.
So like I worked with in Austin on features. I worked with a gaffer in town, and so I've like worked on crews and stuff. And so through that, you start to understand what you need and what you don't need, and what you can get away with. And so for that, because I've worked in, I mean, I worked in war zones and stuff like that. So I really like to go with as small a crew as possible when I'm in a place, particularly with non-actors, because the minute you set up tons of lights and you know, sound equipment, and you've got this huge video village going, people who've never seen a camera, that's really shocking and intimidating, and it's hard to get a genuine performance out of someone in that situation.
Yeah.
Whether it's a documentary, like even if you're doing an interview as a documentary, it's, you know, it's hard to get anyone present when they've got lights on them like crazy, and professional actors are used to it. So because my low budget stuff will be taking place in somewhere where I'll probably be using, you know, either amateur actors or non-actors, I like to go with as small a crew as possible. And because I've done a lot of that, I know what I can get away with and what I can shoot. And particularly also because some of the areas I'll be going to won't have power.
Sure.
And won't have necessarily great lodging. So we can't.
So you
put
need
up
to have MacGyver
crew.
On your crew as well?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or like people who can adjust, you know,
yeah.
people who can carry equipment in high altitude and survive
oh,
in
yeah.
some, you know, some difficult climates. So
I love it. I love it. Power filmmakers. It's like my husband and I watched those like Bear Grylls shows where like they drop people in the middle of wherever
yeah.
and I'm always like, I just wanna see the guy with the camera.
Yeah.
Like I just want that guy. Like they're not allowed to eat unless they find their own thing. But this guy's probably got like a granola bar behind the camera.
Oh yeah.
Like he can eat because he's not part of the thing.
And every time I watch like a documentary on mountaineering, all I can do is think of the cameraman.
Yeah. I mean, it's like it's both gets me in deeper, but then also keeps me slightly outside of it. Like I'm always acknowledging that I'm watching a film, but then I'm always like, there's a person hanging off that mountain holding the camera.
Oh, I know.
Like, what?
I feel like nowadays every one of these adventure docs should have a GoPro attached to the camera. Reversed back to the cameraman just to see what he's having to do to get that gorgeous shot.
Exactly. I mean, that would be so awesome. Man, there should be a whole series of films that are just sort of like internal films for like, check out what Joey did.
Yeah.
He's on the mountain. Watch this. It's like one leg. How's he doing it? Like, yeah. I love it. Man, so that's so interesting that you've done this kind of stuff. You like know how to move through like war zones and like areas where you're not really trying to like mess with their culture so much by being there. You're just trying to capture a little snippet of it or even just use the space to create a story in, you know, but you're not trying to mess with anything. So I like the idea that you have a smaller crew.
Yeah, like with for Yarné, we had this tiny crew, but the monks were half our crew. You know, like we had to build a dolly there. So my DP and the monks, we built the dolly together. Well, of course, we're dealing with child monks, so the first day we go to sleep and we spent all this, you know, ran around town trying to find wheels and stuff. And we had these welders on the street, welded it all together. And then the first night, the little monks snuck out of their beds and took it and threw it down the stairs and bashed it up. So we had we got one day of shooting really well. Then we had to keep patching it up over. And we eventually had to chain it up so that the monks couldn't play on it. Because they're, you know, they would get like 10 at a time and they'd roll down the stairs with it.
Oh, my God. They might be monks, but they're still kids.
Oh, man, they're kids. They're like these little rascals. And they're
That's
hilarious.
So fun.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So I want to ask you, do such a different style, you know, like you mentioned your journey from getting your degree at UT and continuing to be a filmmaker has been very different from other people.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, I mean, but clearly you're still doing it. So, you know, it's a good journey. And I wondered, you know, do you have any advice for other filmmakers that are, you know, both those that are trying to get started and then maybe also, or more importantly, others that hit the wall you hit, that hit the like, I don't want to deal with the BS of this business and getting funding and having to fight just to put this up.
Yeah.
How do they move forward?
I think it all depends on, unfortunately, it's like the stage of filmmaking you are, like the age you are. So if people who are younger, maybe in film school or going to film school or just out of film school, one thing I'd say that's really hard as you get older is you don't really have the same community you used to have when you're young.
Hmm.
So first thing is, you know, hold on to your film school friends, or even if they're not in film school, whatever, it's undergrad friends who are looking to be storytellers, because those are still some of my best, even in Austin and around, those are still some of my best friends and the people I rely on to give me honest feedback. Because it gets really, really hard to get honest feedback.
Yeah.
The older you get, because people are all trying to network contact with one another, and they don't want to give negative feedback in case the next day, you know, you're promoted to something and you just trash their script. So everyone's just kind of nice to each other, unfortunately. And that's, you know, it's great, but if it's not constructive.
Like fake nice, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when you need feedback, you need feedback. Like
yeah.
At the end of the day, as a storyteller, you're there to serve the story, not your own ego. So if you need to be told the truth, it's better to come from people who really care about you and you know that there's some truth behind it. Anyway, so I would say that's number one. Hold on to those friends and, you know, really keep that community together. And then, and then I think, you know, it comes down to necessity, you know, whether storytelling, like filmmaking, is something you really need to do. If it is, then there are so many routes. There's so many different ways that people manage to either have careers as filmmakers, whether they're top directors in Hollywood or otherwise, and doing it internationally. There are a lot of routes. But I will say that, you know, if you don't love it, if it's just something you're doing for, you know, some weird perception that you're either going to get famous or make a lot of money, it's really just the wrong place. There are so many easier ways to make money. I think when you're young, you can, you're not as constricted, you know, like you can go out to LA and meet a lot of people and have a lot of fun. You can do this sort of maybe a route more like mine, which is traveling the world and trying to tell stories from around the world. Ultimately, I think it just comes down to, if it makes you really happy, there's always a route. There is a way to do it.
Yeah.
And it might not be the way you planned or expected. But
it's almost certainly not.
I really don't know anyone's. And it's, you know, it's hard to compare yourself to. Like, I know people who had a lot of success in the beginning, and ultimately, you know, things that appear to be successful, at the end of the day, they're still not proud of their projects. You know, they might have made a lot of money from it or gotten a lot of fame or notoriety and made tons of connections, but they're not very proud of what they've done.
Yeah.
And, I think that's just a very personal question. Like, for me, I would rather not make a dime and be really proud of my work than the opposite. So I think that that's a very personal question of what that takes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's certainly a choice. And like, what part of the industry do you really want to be part of? Like, and also, like, like you said, are you in it just for some inkling of fame or to be near fame? Like, cool. All right, great. There are lots of jobs you could do that probably and not have to make the, like, you know, you could probably just get a job at an agency. You meet all those famous people. Like,
yeah, I mean,
go do that.
Yeah.
If that's what you want to do.
And even in film, you know, it's always been thought of as a director's medium, and now slowly writers are getting more and more, you know, appreciation, which is wonderful. But there's so
many. Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, there's so many roles in filmmaking, though. And it was an interesting thing I remember in film school, because at the very beginning, they ask everyone to raise their hand who wants to be a director, and almost the entire 500 people in the giant auditorium's hands are up. And then by the end, no one wants to be a director. Like, the minute you have to direct and you see how hard it is. Which is, I think the one thing that's really good to go to film school for, though I don't think film school is necessary at all for anyone, but it's useful just to see what you don't want to do.
Yeah, so you could try it out in a low stakes environment and kind of like check it out.
Yeah,
I think that, I actually think that about college in general. Yeah. Like, my husband's very anti-college in that he's like, you know, you can just live your life and you can do whatever you want. It doesn't matter if you have education. I was like, sure, yeah, you can read books. I get you. But college for me was a real great practice adulthood.
I think we,
like,
yeah,
I needed to try.
I think we all like to validate our own past experiences. If you went to film school, you might think it's necessary. If you didn't go, you don't think it's necessary.
Yeah, you're right.
If you live in LA, you think it's necessary. If you don't live in LA for film, you don't think it's, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And in a sense, it's like our parents have their own route, and then they think we need to fulfill their route. It's like we're all sort of replicating our own lives.
You know what, though? That actually really brings me into this idea that I've been thinking about lately about, like, storytelling, like, and about the idea that, like, you're right, regular, your standard human is just like, this is the way I lived my life, so this is the right way, right? But I think that as storytellers, we have a job to see all the other options, that it's our job to see and reflect other points of view and different perspectives. Like, if I only understand my own, then I am not fulfilling my purpose as an artist and storyteller. I need to understand as closely as I possibly can, open myself up to what is it like to be them? What are they going through, so that I could potentially help them tell their story, or, you know, put that out there, and not just have, like we're saying right now, it, my way is the right way.
Yeah, you know? 100%. And even in that, I think there are a lot of routes, because for, I think what you described, something that I like, you know, that's sort of my route, where I like to be an observer, and I really try to at best represent what I see. And but there are others, and we need to, and I think each of our perspectives are unique, and that, as artists, that's where you make your mark. You know, you start to have a unique perspective. But I also think there are some people who are quite brilliant of telling their own story in different ways, and they're really self-reflective and honest, brutally honest about themselves. And I, you know, and I've seen them be very successful, but just in that one format, you know, maybe a one-person show, or maybe, you know, doing something that's very autobiographical, which is really popular right now. Like, a lot of the shows we're seeing are mostly done about, you know, someone's personal story. You're seeing it in comedy and stand-up comedians. We're seeing it in TV shows. And there's, I think there's a lot of validity to that, but
the old person in me is always like, I'm not interesting. I'm trying to tell somebody else's story.
Yeah.
Quit asking me about myself.
I'm the same
like,
way.
I'm fine.
I'm like, I don't know what I have to offer about myself, but you know, here's what I've seen.
Hilariously. Alternately, I was like, well, you know, potentially my listeners would be like, Amy, you got a couple stories, but you have some serious stories. And I was like, you're not like, I grew up and lived in Omaha my whole life or whatever, like never left. And now I work in, you know, coal or whatever. Like, no, you've lived a wild life of adventure and, you know, taking risks. You didn't become a banker.
No,
you didn't go to Nepal to be, you know, like a gold miner or something. Like,
totally.
You legitimately were like, let's be an artist in the realist sense. Like,
I've definitely, much to my family's chagrin, I think I've definitely, you know, escaped death on many routes. Like, I had some particularly, like, the year, I think it's 2015, I was, after the Nepal earthquake, because I had I was in the Annapurnas, in doing a trek in the Annapurnas when it was one of the biggest avalanches and blizzards in modern history, and therefore, and many, many people died, and we were narrowly close. We had helicopters looking for us. It was insane. We just narrowly escaped, and very fortunate to survive. And I was out of touch with my wife for many days, who, like, you know, broke down when we finally was able to call her, because I didn't even think she was watching the news to know that everyone, I mean, unfortunately, it was a tragedy. I mean, so many people died.
Yeah.
And then when we made it back, it wasn't a few months later, I don't know, that the Nepal earthquake hit, and we quite narrowly escaped that. Just to arrive in Houston, and the entire city flooded. And my dad had to call me in the middle of the night to come pick him up in the middle of the freeway on top of his car, because the entire city had flooded. And then, so I was going back to Nepal right after that to do earthquake relief. And two of my friends were going as well, and they had joined some volunteer website, and they said, oh, just look at the website, because I was helping out the monastery. And they said, well, look at the website of places that you can volunteer. So I looked up, and the three top places around the world you can volunteer were all catastrophes I had been in. So there were the Annapurnas, the Kathmandu earthquake, or the floods in Texas. And then the following year, I moved home, and I was in I came home, and Hurricane Harvey hit like right when I landed. So at this point, everyone says, like, we just need to call the Red Cross before I go anywhere, and just tell them to just set up camp.
Get ready.
Yeah. So.
It's not your fault.
I mean, I seem to come out fine.
Right?
No one around me does.
Oh my God. Man, you're learning so much about yourself. You're like, guys, it's super weird. I'm invincible. I didn't know that this was a situation.
Yeah, it was like, it was like 6 months ago, my dad called me and says, are you in Houston? I said, no. He said, well, a tornado just came down our street, and I figured you had to be nearby.
At least he loves you and called. Oh my God, what a dad thing to say.
Yeah.
Oh man, that's so funny. Well, hey, listen, thank you so much for sharing story and chatting with me about everything.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a blast.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate you talking. If only just because, like, you're so humble, and like, you're in the midst of your own journey. So you're like, yeah, I guess this is what life is. And it's like, wow, you don't even understand how wild and amazing the story you just told. told me is.
Oh, that's so
like,
sweet.
And that's
Thank
so
you.
Great. But it's almost, it's better. Don't know. Don't forget about it. You don't know about it. I'll write it in the post. Don't read it. Don't read it. But like your journey, like the fact that you're just going to keep traveling to these places and making the, telling these stories, and it doesn't even like, we will find them and they will be out there for us to consume and to like experience what you've put out in the world. And, you know, no amount of like any movie producer or anything will stop that. And I really just appreciate that your artistry will be out in the world no matter what form that it takes. Because you seem excited and you seem to have this fun energy that's going to propel cool stories. So,
you
know, keep going.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.